estar cerca.
Coming back there from the sounds, or specifically welcoming you to this morning's edition of my Sunday Morning Take. Obviously, this is as we lead into what is... technically is the first Sunday of the month of October. And obviously, welcoming you this morning, dear listeners, to your somewhat spring-ish Sunday morning sessions. I have seen that since Saturday yesterday into this particular morning, some cloud cover has been ghosting about here in the Windhoek facility. The Windhoek vicinity. Obviously, wherever you find yourself, you know, if you've also primarily seen the same particular kind of phenomenon, don't look anything into it, guys. Until we see the particular evidence that, you know, the rainfall actually comes a little bit early this year, do stay a little bit suspicious, because climate change has not been our best buddy in terms of being a for sure thing. It has ultimately given us the mixed signals we've always sort of like been trying to interpret for the past 5 years in terms of how, you know, we've understood each other as both presenter and you as the listener, in terms of trying to look into what, you know, can't we have a more accurate but predictable weather patterns. And unfortunately, guys, you know, these past 5 years have been tumultuous, have been just haywire analysis and all that. So it's not pretty straightforward in terms of getting to the particular point. But here on my Sunday Morning Take, obviously, where we obviously try to get into the discussions and help understand and also gauge, I say gauge, not engage, to gauge and broach certain particular conversations and subject matters. This is one said particular Sunday morning session where we get into a discussion that is actually unique in its own right, because it once again places us into a scenario of its slash geography and slash, slash history slash geography in its own right. It gets us into the conversation, based upon what we've actually been observing for the past 3 years here in the global realm, specifically of, you know, the fallout that has been transmitted since the Ukraine conflict began. I'm not talking about the Ukraine conflict, don't worry, guys. But there has been a particular attitude and a particular behavior addressed towards specifically Russia. You would have observed this. You would have noticed it in certain particular kinds of public platforms and discussions around the world specifically. And regarding how the rest of the world, I'm talking now, the rest of the world split between the non-aligned movement countries and the countries associated to NATO, how they've reacted. Now, the non-aligned movement obviously includes us, Namibia. But the non-aligned movement also has a particular role in terms of where we continuously advocate for peaceful means and peaceful resolutions, and thus advocate for discussions and negotiations to be the be-all and end-all before people actually resort to any forms of violence and conflict. You would see it in any speeches that Namibia's president and Namibia's Minister of International Relations, any platforms that where they've got to give a speech, they would reiterate this particular stance that Namibia has. It is a very good stance. It is a stance that doesn't actually take any particular sides, because primarily in that scenario, you see that we ask, hey, listen, guys, before you pick up guns, before you decide to cause damage to each other's infrastructure and whatnot, and, you know, cause extensive damage to environments and incur loss of life, first talk to each other. First, go sit around the table and negotiate and talk to each other. Now, it brings us up to a conversation that I've actually observed for the better part of this past 3 years. Now, actually, I observed it and took notice of it, but I never really went and said, you know what, let me clock this down as a conversation point pre-COVID. So meaning before 2020, I didn't observe this thing much. But it actually, in the past 3 years, obviously since the 2022 conflict, the start of the Ukraine conflict, it has become super obvious, this particular subject matter. And the subject matter we're going to be focusing on for this morning's conversation, dear listeners, is that based upon Russophobia. The opposite of Russophobia is obviously Russophilia, meaning Russophobia being, you know, the sort of like heightened fear discussion or dimensions in terms of, you know, the countries that are obviously doing their best in terms of sort of like blacklisting, you know, Russia itself. And obviously also Russophilia is the opposite, meaning, you know, applauding and lauding the, you know, the various particular gains or supposed developments that obviously Russia has achieved. Just to let you know, this is not, this particular conversation this morning is not sort of like to be a fan of anything Russia does. Just to let you know, because obviously here on Eagle FM, we obviously strive to give you the most neutral, most objective particular analysis. And so just so that you know, this is no sort of like promotional activity based upon Russia. It's just to cite the various talking points that exist, have been observed. That's also where academics have actually taken cognizance of the subject matter. And we're looking at the roots. Where does this come from? Where does Russophobia come from? The biggest proponent of this Russophobia discussion has been NATO. There's no, literally no doubt about that. The biggest proponent of Russophobia has been NATO. Now, you would have obviously seen in the recent developments since June, July, obviously, with the German Chancellor and the German Parliament, obviously illustrating that massive infrastructure expenditure bill that they brought in the middle of the year, it was one of the reasons as to why the elections took place earlier this year in Germany, where obviously the former Chancellor Olaf Scholz thus became sort of like a negotiating partner in a new coalition government with the newly voted in Chancellor of Germany, that being Friedrich Merz. And Merz's whole idea was to try, technically the accusations exist in Germany that Merz technically copy and pasted Scholz's particular expenditure plan for the next particular 5-year period. So if you don't know what the expenditure plan actually encapsulates in Germany, is that they are going to reinforce infrastructure, infrastructure that can carry a tank. Now, if you don't know what that signals, it's primarily is that there's this massive fear, specifically in Western Europe, regarding a potential invasion from Russia. I don't know where they're getting it from. But you also see, it is, this has obviously also come to a new level, a new heightened level of suspicion towards Russia with the recent accusations. You guys would have heard of the drones that were shot down, recently over in Polish airspace, supposedly flying over from, you know, from the Ukraine conflict into the airspace of Poland because Ukraine and Poland border onto each other. There have been accusations thrown. One of the particular accusations obviously coming through from this discussion has been how the whole of the EU cluster has cited, yeah, this is how invasions start, supposedly, and all manner of, you know, rhetoric has been dispensed. However, on these particular notions, the accusation also is cited primarily that the movement of arms, obviously, and the billing of supplies is at an all-time high. If you guys remember the particular conversation we had on the home run regarding the peace and security report that Antonio Guterres had released just before the 80th UN General Assembly session, the UN peace and security report cites primarily the cost of, well, the financing and the cost of war around the world. Countries have spent more money or are spending more money in arming themselves than actually achieving or concentrating or actually budgeting substantially more for achieving various sustainable goals in terms of what they signed up to under the UN discussion or under the UN negotiating mechanisms known as those SDGs. More countries are spending more money on weapons. Now, it obviously brings you up to a particular talking point that shows you that there's heightened mistrust around the world between nations, that there's heightened distrust even at the UN General Assembly level, because this year's session was marred with accusations and accusations and more accusations and furthermore accusations. It's probably just us Africans that didn't show up there to accuse anyone as yet, even though we've got the AU's particular theme running, actively running. I still need to look up in terms of for how long that theme will run, because that theme can't just be active for 1 year. It's got to have like multiple cycles. It's probably just us Africans that didn't show up there, you know, wagging a finger at anyone. Even though our biggest concerns had been we need to actively pursue the various particular, agreed upon goals within the climate crisis or within the climate negotiation sphere of things, primarily because that's the single most existential threat that we all face on the planet. Okay, obviously also you know, partnering that up with the spending on armaments and military hardware. Now, the Russophobia, bringing you back to the Russophobia conversation, dear listeners, is obviously something that you would have also obviously also noticed this as well. And it's the same particular propaganda that also is stoked against China specifically. If you guys have not seen this before, it does exist, but you don't get any other kind of similar treatment towards any other nation around the world. Now, what actually, one of the particular things that actually started off this conversation for this morning, it was also that specifically on this day in 1853, the Crimean War is announced or actually kicks off between the Ottoman Turks and Russia, And that was when Russia still had a monarchy. So they were Imperial Russia at that stage. And later on, the Crimean War is joined by the English and the French in terms of them obviously, you know, supporting the Ottomans against the Russians. Now, the fighting lasted for more than 2 years and it ended with Russia's particular defeat. If you guys did not know, Crimea specifically has been a particular piece of territory that has also been a hotly contested territory today. One of the singularly most important things about that piece of territory, it has actually also flared up in terms of the recent Ukraine conflict, in terms of when many people thought that Crimea was actually Ukrainian territory. One of the biggest concerns has been is that one side, the Russians, actively explained to everyone around the world in their press conferences that there is no legally binding document that exists that indicates that Crimea is Ukraine. It was sort of like a gift given to Ukraine. That was the explanation given. And this particular gift was a scenario of saying, hey, listen, you guys may have this particular facility, this particular piece of land, because the strategic purpose of Crimea was that it had a naval base, a Soviet naval base, you know, from, you know, the Cold War era that was positioned there. Now, obviously, at that stage in 2014, the Russians obviously thought, you know what, we don't want to be bottlenecked in the Black Sea. If you don't know, guys, that has been one of the particular military strategies that was obviously deployed by the Russians. And so they technically took over the Crimean Peninsula itself and the subsequent naval base that's positioned there. Because if they were bottlenecked in the Black Sea, just so that you know, it would have made things a lot more difficult, because the other particular port that Ukraine had was it Mariupol, and then there was another port town or port city, and it would have made things pretty difficult for the Russians, because that meant they did not have much of a port facility also in the rest of the Black Sea facilities. Obviously pointing out that, you know, this was a discussion about strategy and, you know, having the strategic advantage as best as possible. Now, you would sometimes find in the realm of our conversation for this morning, the Russophobia, is that it is sometimes identified digitally online as anti-Russian sentiment. You would have also heard from Benjamin Netanyahu in terms of identifying the sentiment against Israel as obviously, you know, what are they called? What's anti-Semitic, which is one of the terms being used. But just to, you know, just to sensitize you on the term Semitic, is that the word Semitic implies that you are talking about the whole Middle East, that whole neighborhood where Israel and Palestine and Jordan and Syria is. You're talking about that whole neighborhood. So if you're calling someone anti-Semitic, you're calling someone a label, technically where they are discriminating against anyone from that neighborhood where that cluster of countries that I just mentioned are. So just so that you know, guys, also just be careful in terms of the labeling and obviously also the understanding of these particular labels as they obviously come through from the academics on, you know, from various parts of the world. Now, the anti-Russian sentiment and or the Russophobia that we're obviously focusing on for this morning is a dislike or a fear of Russia, Russian people, and Russian culture. You would have obviously also seen this in movies, specifically. You would have also seen this in other particular programming, even like in news reporting, and more. Now, the opposite of this, Russophobia, is obviously known as Russophilia. Now, historically, Russophobia has included state-sponsored and grassroots mistreatment and discrimination, as well as also propaganda that contains anti-Russian sentiments. Specifically in Europe, Russophobia was based on various more or less fantastic fears. Well, the literature uses the word fantastic. Obviously, me being a Namibian and an African, you know, I'm literally way outside that particular realm, and I'm just looking in. It's difficult to say that someone is actually hallucinating, primarily, but you also need to look at his history that helps to depict a particular picture. I mean, twice, two particular fantastical European leaders tried to invade Russia, whether it be Imperial Russia in the 1800s or Soviet Russia in the modern day context, which just was a lot larger as a territory. They both fantastically failed on an epic and grand scale, both of them. And the only thing that defeated them was not the warfare and the fighting. The only thing that defeated them was because they could not survive the Russian winters. They could not. It's the only thing that put Napoleon around. Napoleon was into Moscow. He took Moscow. But then he didn't have any supplies. His supply lines were too small, were too thin. The front line, the war front line, was too big to maintain. The particular winter was becoming harsh. Yep. And what did he have to do? He had to turn all the way back and march back in that winter. The same thing for the Germans in World War II. They reached Moscow, they reached St. Petersburg as well, because they also had to strategically take St. Petersburg. The downside, when the Russian winter came, that first Russian winter, it literally was a nightmare. So, based upon that sentiment, obviously you see the particular viewpoints and the discussions that emanate from there. In terms of that, it was based upon various fears of Russian conquest of Europe, such as those that were based on the will of Peter the Great. This was a 1700s particular fear that was promoted between the French. Now, the will of Peter the Great according to the literature, it's known as a political forgery. It was supposed some sort of propaganda that aimed to express the geopolitical testament of the Russian Emperor Peter I, which allegedly contained a plan for the subjugation of Europe. But for many years, it actually only influenced political attitudes in Great Britain and in France towards the Russian Empire. And it was technically, and it's known here also as a forgery document in France in the 19th century. And it later on resurfaced in Britain as a result of the fears of a Russian attack on British colonized India. If you guys did not know, because of primarily the spread of communism, obviously, during the 1900s. Yes, the 1900s, guys, which is also known as the 20th century. And this is obviously also in relation to what was known under the British strategy or strategies that they deployed as the Great Game. Now, the Great Game actually took place in the 1800s, in the 19th century, was a rivalry between the British and the Russian empires over influence in Central Asia. Now, here's where things get interesting. That influence or that strategy playing scenario is something that has popped up time and time again when the economist Jeffrey Sachs has a public engagement somewhere else, wherever he finds himself. And then he makes use of the word game theory. Now, I don't know if you guys have heard, for specifically you political science students and learners in Namibia, I don't know if you guys have heard of game theory in any kind of scenario, because economists also have to study political economy in countries. Specifically, even though I try my best to ignore political economy, because I know that political economy is determined by the policies, the successful or victorious policies from whoever won a national election, either for presidency or, you know, to be in, to have the majority in the National Assembly. The greatest particular scenario from this is that no one seems to be resembling these various kinds of strategy documents. I don't know if it exists in the Namibian context, but this is not what I have seen primarily. I probably have not seen it. Maybe in a salient manner. Maybe. So the great game, as it was known, was that obviously, at that stage in the 19th century, the British and the Russians at the time were vying and competing for influence in Central Asia. If you guys did not know, the British apparently were in Tibet. They were apparently in Tibet, because they had famous battles there as well. There was obviously also the influence over 19th century Imperial China, which the Chinese also till the day do not forget. There was also the influence over some of the particular Central Asia countries that border onto southern Russia. So I'm talking about the Tajikistan, because the British attempted to go into Afghanistan. I say they attempted because Greater India, before how you understand modern day India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh today, was those three countries together. And the British wanted to obviously expand their influence in the southern parts of Asia, as well as also the Central Asia region. And because Russia is a country that has a large border into the Central Asian vicinity, it obviously would have meant that these two particular European powers would come into contact with each other, specifically in that neighborhood. So the British were obviously doing their thing, you know, firstly sending in the, what was that company's name? The East India Company. And then obviously trying to see, you know, what control would be established there. If you guys did not know, this was potentially the world's richest company before modern economics popped up, the East India Company. It was a company becoming so powerful that the British king literally had to pass a law back in England to outlaw this company, to dissolve a private company, because it had a bigger standing army than the British army. It was, but the only thing it didn't have in large, in a large scenario was a navy. Like a military navy, not a commercial navy. It had a commercial navy that connected England specifically to its particular colonial possessions and vice versa. So, and it was literally determining prices. It was literally determining a lot of particular things in the UK at that stage. Now, the two colonial empires obviously used military interventions and diplomatic negotiations to acquire and redefine territories in the Central Asian region. I once saw a early version of Russian expansion, specifically the early days in terms of the coastal town that hosts the coastal city that hosted the Winter Olympics in Russia, that being Sochi. I saw that it was actually just a painting, because they didn't have cameras at that stage. But it was a painting specifically of the Russian Navy, and they would send an exploratory force. So this exploratory force would be a bunch of soldiers that would be sent. You need to clear out land, you need to establish a military base, you need to do this, you need to do that. And then settlers are brought, and then they establish a town. The town then becomes like a fixed installation, and from there they just carve out supply infrastructure transport infrastructure to connect that settlement with other settlements, and so it went. So the Russians were obviously back in the 19th century, they had to roll out various particular expansionary policies. And obviously how you did that back in the 19th century was that you used your army. You send an they call it an expedition force. You send an expedition force with supplies. They need to go find out what's there. They need to go see what's there. Then you send back reports. Then we make planning. Then we plan from there. And then we adequately, you know, we do the necessary resource allocation scenario, which is one of the most clear cut and very obvious, you know, mechanisms in terms of how, settlement policies took place. Now, pre-existing anti-Russian sentiment in Germany also is considered to be one of the factors that also has influenced treatment of Russian the Russian population under German occupation during World War II. I'd actually slightly put a bookmark or a little peg in there because it actually has been well documented that the failed Austrian painter actively gave an order to the German army during the Second World War that he does not want any prisoners of war from the Red Army, the Soviet Army at the time. That all, and if it was women were to be executed on the spot. If it was men, maltreatment obviously needed to take place. But here's the worst, here's the worst of the worst. His political dimension was socialism. Joseph Stalin's political dimension was communism. Two particular political ideologies which are the closest to each other, but these two men hated each other. They actively hated each other, if you did not know. Even though they signed a pact or a treaty of whoever attacks who first, you know, actually is identified as the aggressor legally. And then in that pact, they decided, you know what, let's be greedy and let's split up Poland. Let's split Poland between us. So if Poland actually has natural enemies today, which is a yes, it is on both sides of its border. Poland actually has two natural enemies. But anyway, a variety of popular culture cliches and negative stereotypes about Russians also still exist, specifically in the Western world. Some individuals have also may have prejudice or even hatred against Russians due to history, racism, propaganda, or even ingrained stereotypes. Now, the negative views of Russia are actually widespread, but most prevalent in Western liberal democracies. Some analysts have also argued that the official Western rhetoric and journalism about Russian actions abroad, such as the Second Chechen War, the 2008 Russian-Georgian War, and the Russian interference in the 2016 United States elections, have contributed to the resurgence of anti-Russian sentiment. Now, the anti-Russian sentiment rose considerably after the start of the Russian war against Ukraine in 2014. By the summer of 2020, the majority of Western nations had unfavorable views of Russia. Now, you've got to ask yourself why. You've got to ask yourself why. Following the 2022 invasion, obviously, of Ukraine, Russian-speaking immigrants experienced harassment, open hostility, and discrimination, regardless of whether or not they were ethnic Russians or not. Now, some researchers have described the narratives of Russophobia as a propaganda tactic that is used by the government of Russia and its supporters. That has been the accusation, supposedly. These narratives emphasize the belief that Russia faces an existential threat from the Western powers and must take drastic measures to ensure domestic stability, including support for the ongoing war in Ukraine. Now, obviously, the picture is one based upon, you know, the Russophobia conversation. Now, the anti-Russian sentiment, and we're doing a deep dive right now, guys. The anti-Russian sentiment actually began in Europe, as obvious, as always. And it has a long history in Europe, dating back at least 700 years. It was largely driven by religious and cultural differences, specifically religious primarily because the Russians are Russian Orthodox. So there is no Catholicism. There's also no Protestantism, meaning You won't find a Lutheran church there. You won't find any of these other Pentecostal churches, you know, that you would find here in Namibia. You won't find them in Russia. There's only Russian Orthodox. And then you find, in the other particular federations, which you can think of as provinces of Russia, you would find the, if the majority religion there is Islam, you would find, the necessary religious installations there. But alongside it, you would find the Church of Russia present, the Russian Orthodoxy also present there. So you would then, and then obviously there's some of the other guys of Russia have a weird religion. I don't know if I can call it a religion, because if you go to the coldest city of Russia, which is Yakutsk, Yakutsk in the province of Yakutia, the scenario there is that these guys don't follow Russian, either Islam or the Russian Orthodox Church. So, you know, they have got their own religion running around there. And this is primarily the cultural identities, obviously, that you would find in that country. But as mentioned, the sentiment in terms of, you know, what we've seen in Africa towards Russia has evolved over time. But the underlying themes, obviously, of perceived barbarism, imperialism, and cultural inferiority still remain particular constants today. Now, if you go back to the earliest forms of what had been measured back then of this anti-Russian sentiment has been between the 15th to the 17th century. So this is a long thing. This is a long thing to help you understand. But before we actually continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short musical break and a short break itself and come back right after that.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not a fraud, it's a scandal. Scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You're the person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Don't go falling away. You got me. That rain.
So coming back there from the musical break right there, and obviously the sounds there that you just heard was M83 with the song Amnesia. Before that, it was Leon Bridges with the song When a Man Cries. And before that, it was the particular sounds of, well, the song's name was Ride. But obviously, you know, just setting the scene there from The Empire of the Sun. That's the group's name that song, sang that song. And it gets us back to our early understanding, obviously, in terms of where this aspect of Russophobia actually emanates from. So, now the negative views of Russia and Europe began, supposedly, to take shape in the 15th century during the period of the Russian expansion into non-Russian lands under Ivan III. Now, Russia's campaigns against Poland, Lithuania, and the Livonian cities and the Swedish-held Finland marked the beginning of said particular perception of Russia as a threat. Now, during this era, Russia was often portrayed as a barbaric, unchristian, and imperialistic nation by its European adversaries. Now, another particular academic argued that the Crusades of the 13th century against the Russian Christian cities like Novgorod and Pskov may highlight even more deeply rooted religious and cultural animosity between what we see today and what actually started back then. During the Livonian War of 1558 to 1583, the European powers, particularly Poland, Lithuania, and the Livonian German cities, intensified their negative perception of Russia. They imposed embargoes on war supplies to Russia, fearing the possibility of it receiving military supplies from England, which had an active trade mission in Russia. At that stage, the English Queen, Elizabeth I, denied said particular accusations from existing. Contemporaries also described the Tsardom of Russia and early Russian Empire as a barbaric enemy of Christianity. Accounts by Western travelers, like the Austrian ambassador of the time, Sigismund von Herberstein, and the English ambassador Giles Fletcher in the 16th century, portrayed Russia in a negative light, focusing on aspects like superstition, brutality, and backwardness. Now, the negative views persisted into the 17th and into the 18th centuries itself, with Western observers continuing to highlight aspects like superstition, drunkenness, and barbaric practices in Russian society. Now, notable figures like the captain John Perry and the French travelers of Jacques Margaret and Jean-Jacques de Otteroche contributed to these particular perceptions as well, and often compared Russian society unfavorably with Western standards. You get into the next period, the 18th to the 19th centuries, itself. So 18th and 19th, obviously, meaning 1700s to the 1800s. On 19 October 1797, the French Directory received a document from a Polish general, Michal Sokolinski. Now, the French Directory, if you don't know, was a system of the French government that was established by the French Constitution, and it takes its name from the committee of five men vested with executive power. Five men vested with executive power. The Directory governed the French First Republic from 26 October 1795 until 10 November 1799. And that's obviously just after Napoleon came into office. Now, they received a document, as mentioned, from a friend, from a Polish general by the name of Sokolnitsky, which was titled Aperture sur la Russie. It's identified here as a forgery, guys. I can't prove said particular forgery. This forgery, known as the so-called The Will of Peter the Great, and was first published in October of 1812, during the Napoleonic Wars itself. And this is when Charles-Louis Le Sœur's much-read Des Progrès de la Puissance Russe. This was at the behest of Napoleon I, who ordered a series of articles to be published showing that Europe is inevitably in the process of becoming booty for Russia. If you don't know what the word booty actually means, it's not the derogatory term of modern day English, obviously, misaligned by modern day urban culture through the means of rap culture. The word booty means loot, or prize, as a prize specifically. Now, you can obviously see and hear that this was the first particular format of propaganda, in terms of military propaganda, that obviously popped up. Now, subsequent to the Napoleonic Wars, the propaganda against Russia was continued by Napoleon's former confessor, Dominique Georges Frédéric Desprat, who in a series of books portrayed Russia as a power-grasping, barbaric, power-hungry to conquer Europe, with reference to Russia's new constitutional laws that kicked in 1811, which was known as the Savoyard, which were in the Savoyard philosopher, Joseph de Maistre wrote the now famous statement, quote, Every nation gets the government it deserves. End of quote. Meaning it was translated from the phrase toute nation a le gouverneur, gouvernement qu'elle mérite. So, saying that every nation gets the government it deserves. From 1815 and lasting roughly until 1840, British commentators then also began criticizing the perceived conservatism of the Russian state and its resistance to reform efforts. So by 1836, the Westminster Review attributed growth of British Navy to, start of quote, ministers that are smitten with the epidemic disease of Russophobia, end of quote. However, the Russophobia in Britain for the rest of the 19th century was primarily related to British fears that the Russian conquest of Central Asia was a precursor to an attack on British colonized India. These fears led to the Great Game, a series of political and diplomatic confrontations between Britain and Russia during the late 19th and early 20th centuries. These particular scenarios, obviously, dear listeners, cites to you, you know, the importance of why we obviously look back in history to see what was being committed there. Because the same thing is happening right now. It's just a scenario that today, on the block of international relations and obviously in terms of the global community, I mean, there's even a conversation happening whether or not globalization is actually dead. And I actually encourage you to read into those kinds of conversations to see what the academics of other parts of the world are actually talking about, because, we're obviously seeing a great amount of developments happening and kicking off. And one of them obviously has been the discussions in terms of, you know, what now? After UN General Assembly 80, what now? What's gonna come after this? Because we've just seen talking and talking and talking, rhetoric. And that is even something that you can apply to the, to the African Union's particular theme. Through reparations because of, you know, Africa, because of colonialism. What now? How are you guys going to go about this particular discussions? Because we've only heard talking. Now, getting back to the Russophobia discussion for today, heading into 1843, another French, aristocrat known as Marquis de Custine, published his largely successful 1,800-page, four-volume travelogue, my goodness, known as La Russie in 1839. So, it was a book written by this gentleman, the Marquis de Custine, which was highly critical of Russian society. It was banned in Russia during the era of the Russian Empire. Due to this particular work, Custine was later on dubbed by some historians as the Tocqueville of Russia. Now, Custine's scathing narrative re-ran what were by now cliches, which represented Russia as a place where the veneer of European civilization was too thin to be credible. Such was its huge success that several official and pirated editions actually quickly followed, as well as condensed versions and translations into German, Dutch, and English. By 1846, approximately 200,000 copies had been sold of this particular book. In 1867, Fyodor Tyutchev, a Russian poet, a diplomat, and also a member of the Imperial Majesty's own chancellery, that's obviously of the Russian Emperor, introduced the actual term of Russophobia in a letter to his daughter Anna Aksakova on 20 September 1867, where he applied it to a number of pro-Western Russian liberals who, pretending that they were merely following their liberal principles, developed a negative attitude towards their own country and always stood on a pro-Western, anti-Russian position, regardless of any changes in the Russian society and having a blind eye on any violations of these principles in the West. Violations in the sphere of justice, morality, and even civilization. Now, he put the emphasis on the irrationality of this particular sentiment. Now, Tyutchev saw Western anti-Russian sentiment as a result of the misunderstanding that was caused by civilizational differences between East and West. Now, I'll park the bus right there, dear listeners, since we've sort of like, flowed over the midway point. Parking the bus there with this particular interjection just to help you set the scene. So, I'll draw your memory banks back to a discussion that took place last year, actually. Now, this is the historic engagement between the veteran TV host, Tucker Carlson, where he, after he obviously left Fox in the US, and he went and, you know, decided to become this podcaster himself, and one of his sort of like killer, I'll call it killer, apologies for the word, but killer engagements was obviously the more than 2-hour interview that he had with the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, last year. But here's the thing, guys. Tucker Carlson sat down, obviously as an American, and obviously not representing Fox News anymore, or Fox anymore. He obviously approached this discussion like I approach it many times. I approach it from a scientific perspective, meaning, help me understand what is going on. If, you know, I have read the basics on, you know, what the underlying subject matter might and supposedly contains. But I want to understand, what is the crux of the matter? So Tucker Carlson obviously walked in there with that particular same hat on. And for anyone that has seen that or viewed it on the internet, on YouTube specifically, because Tucker Carlson has a YouTube channel as well. If you've seen it on YouTube as well, he asked the first question. They did the introductions, you know, the niceties and everything. And obviously you have to understand, guys, it was pre-recorded. It wasn't like one of Carlson's live discussions that he sometimes has, but it was a pre-recorded conversation because, obviously Putin can speak English, but he spoke in Russian. And then Putin speaks in Russian. And then Putin takes Carlson on a 1-hour history trip of the background of Russia. Now, some political commentators and some particular, commentators also on YouTube itself, because there's a lot of streamers there as well. Everyone was sort of like disappointed with the start that Putin gave. When Putin started off a question where, Tucker Carlson asked him, you know, it was a question of the origins of this discussion. You know, what's actually going on here? Putin gave him that 1-hour history lesson. So many people were calling off, yeah, this is a scam. This is Putin doing this. This is Putin doing that. Which obviously depicted in terms of how various people employ or deploy critical thinking themselves. But I'll explain to you today why he took Tucker Carlson on a 1-hour history lesson in the first hour of that show, of that episode. Primarily to combat narratives about a country, about his country, about Russia. And immediately, dear listeners, I will kid you not. Any commentator that you see, and you can go and try and analyze this yourself as well. If you watch the episode, I didn't completely finish watching it because, I mean, that first hour was literally the, you know, and it's a bit difficult, man, just reading subtitles and listening to Putin explain, but it was interesting stuff, but sometimes, you know, the subtitles gets a little bit heavy. When you go and look at the analysis that some people gave after that, they were acting flippant, you know, towards the conversation that first 1 hour. Some people were saying, yeah, this is obviously what a head of state would do. They would show up and, you know, start spouting, propaganda, stuff like that. People were sort of like diminishing Putin. But if you go look at them reacting to any other head of state around the world, you would have to ask yourself a critical particular question. Do people actually listen, or do they only respond to what they think is actually happening? I'll point this out as well. This has been a similar particular scenario in terms of leadership, even here in Namibia. Recently, traditional leaders are very hesitant to talk to us, the media. Not us, Eagle FM. The media, like in general. I'm talking about the landscape. Primarily because it seems like there's some sort of a negative feeling between, from the traditional leaders scenario towards the media landscape. Because the accusations that have existed are that, you know, many of these traditional leaders are being misquoted, or they are being portrayed in a negative light that negatively impacts their particular standing in their local communities, wherever. Now, I don't know. Dear listeners, I cannot, you know, prescribe something to a fellow media practitioner. None of the person works here with me at Eagle FM. Obviously, I can try and help them and, you know, show them the ropes and coach them a little bit. But if it's someone from another media, there's nothing I can do. The downside has been I have come across so many particular sentiments wherein people from leadership roles across the Namibian landscape, Namibian society have said, but we don't trust you guys because you guys go and say the opposite of what we just told you. You guys go and portray us in certain particular lights against what we told you, against what actually happened, against these particular things. Now, obviously, critical thinking obviously takes place. But the media itself is a very strong tool. Narrative management is a fine art. Narrative management is a fine art. And no bigger narrative has been perpetrated in Namibia specifically. For example, like the narrative that sprouted from the COVID-19 vaccines. Vaccines, multiple. Multiple. And I will still tell you, this is just someone that's obviously someone that's open to knowledge. Go and read up on the Reuters investigation in terms of where did all the negative propaganda come from regarding vaccines. You will be surprised who's behind it. You will be surprised. I mentioned it once on the Home Run. Go and read up. For those of you that are anti-vaxxers in Namibia, go and read up about it. And you will understand specifically how you were literally swindled into believing a false narrative that did not exist. Now, obviously, getting you back, bringing you back, dear listeners, to this particular discussion, because it obviously is crucial in terms of highlighting the power of the message, the power of communication. And this has been an exercise that I've shown you greatly, because this shows you narrative, this shows you propaganda, this shows you what do they call that thing when you plant a negative concept in someone's mind? Just through narrative. So you've obviously seen the particular discussion that took place, and I ended on the particular example and case study of Tucker Carlson's engagement with Vladimir Putin. Putin taking that 1 hour tour, giving Carlson that 1 hour tour through Russian history. Which obviously set the particular scene, because these particular engagements have to highlight, dear listeners, that you have to be careful. If you're not a reader, if you're not someone that has extensively gone out to try and understand the conversation, and a TikTok video has never given anyone any format of wisdom. I'm sorry, guys. This is even proven. Because even the TikTok guys get the message wrong. Even the TikTok guys get the message wrong. So, there's nothing wrong. If you're a tic-tac, not a tic-tac. TikTok is the mint. If you're a TikTok follower or a TikTok consumer, I'm really sorry, but unfortunately, you know, there's just so many wrongs that that particular platform, the users of that platform, has propagated, and unfortunately, still don't understand in terms of the broader context of what's actually going on in the world. So, it's only a handful of them. I'd put it like that. It's only a handful of those guys that actually, you know, get the situation wrong. Oh, situation right, sorry. Bringing you back to where we left off in terms of the earliest formats of this anti-Russia sentiment, heading now obviously into the Second World War chapter of this particular anti-Russia sentiment. Now, this particular chapter, dear listeners, takes things to a unique dimension. And when I say unique, I mean it gets severe. So obviously, as you do know, the failed Austrian painter, I won't mention his name, and his party at that stage, which was known as the Nationalist Socialists, regarded Slavic peoples, which were predominantly people from Poland and people from, you know, the Eastern Slavs of Europe, as non-Aryan. So they had this very ugly word known as subhuman. In German, it was known as Untermenschen. Yes, guys, it's German and Afrikaans are pretty close to each other, so don't worry. And this particular classification obviously meant that crimes against humanity could be perpetuated. Now, as early as 1925, said particular failed Austrian painter suggested in his own book, which I also won't mention, but because it's also very weird that there's a few Africans that are seeking to read this man's book. It's actually one of the books that you should not read. It's actually one of the books you should not read. When I say you should not read, because it's a vile, it's a man that committed one of history's worst crimes. And you actively want to go and read what this man had in his head? Really? Really? But anyway. In that particular book of the failed Austrian painter, he indicated obviously that the German people needed Lebensraum. Now Lebensraum is known as living space. To achieve German expansion towards Drang nach Osten, this was obviously a particular term used by the German nationalists in terms of expanding territories into Central and Eastern Europe. This combines obviously medieval territories back then, you know, so I'm talking about way back, these particular, because much of the German expansionism during the period just before the Second World War was based literally on medieval historical territorial designations. And these were some of the base, some of the platforms that the failed Austrian painter actually emphasized these expansionist policies in Europe. Now, he also believed that the organization of the Russian state formation was not the result of the political abilities of the Slavs in Russia, but only a wonderful example of the state forming efficacy of the German element in an inferior race. End of quote. That was literally what he explained there. Because if you don't know that, you know, Russia also has Germanic roots in terms of genealogy, DNA. It also has Germanic roots. You get a lot of Russians with German surnames, like Adler, the surname Adler. You get a lot of them. There's another one. There's a whole bunch of those particular surnames in Russia. So, after the invasion of the Soviet Union, the failed Austrian painter then expressed his plans for the Slavs in Russia by saying, "As for the ridiculous 100 million Slavs, we will hold the best of them as we see fit, and we will isolate the rest of them in pigsties." Do you see the level? And anyone who talks about cherishing the local inhabitants and civilizing them goes straight off into a concentration camp. End of quote. So obviously the plans to eliminate Russians and other Slavs from the Soviet territory to allow German settlement included starvation. The American historian Timothy Snyder maintains that there were at least 4.2 million victims of the German hunger plan in the Soviet Union, which were largely Russian, Belarusians, and Ukrainians, which also included 3.1 million Soviet POWs and 1 million civilian deaths in the siege of Leningrad. Now, according to Snyder, the failed Austrian painter, because I refuse to mention his name, intended eventually to exterminate up to 45 million people by planned famine as part of Generalplan Ost. Influenced by the guidelines, in a directive sent out to the troops under his command, the German general, Erich Hübner of the 4th Panzer Army, stated, "The war against Russia is an important chapter in the German nation's struggle for existence. It is the old battle of the Germanic against the Slavic people, of the defense of the European culture against Muscovite Asiatic inundation, and the repulsion of Jewish Bolshevism. The objective of this battle must be the demolition of the present-day Russia and must therefore be conducted with unprecedented severity. Every military action must be guided in planning and execution by an iron resolution to exterminate the enemy remorselessly and totally. In particular, no adherents of the contemporary Russian Bolshevik system are to be spared." End of quote. So you can obviously see that the sentiment was pretty strong from one particular direction. Now, during the Second World War, obviously, you know, it saw the Soviet Union definitely become an ally of the British and of the Americans. But what you also did not know is that the British technically somewhat partially invaded the Russians just during the First World War period. If you guys don't know, there's a lovely sort of like well-hidden chapter somewhere in human history about that discussion. Which is also part of the discussions actually in terms of another particular subject matter, which is an interesting statistical analysis of how many countries did Britain actually invade across the world. Or actually had a presence in some way or other militarily in that scenario. We roll into the Cold War era. The Cold War era obviously is a very interesting particular take because this is not obviously where you see the East versus West conversation, but not the East as in Asia, as the New East had been now been described. Because you guys would obviously see in a contemporary conversation scenario, if you now talk about East globally, in globalization and in global trade and in global policy narratives, anyone would know that this obviously speaks to Beijing. This speaks to China. This could be China and India with all the other particular parties in the Asia theater in terms of global policy, global trade, and all other kinds of things, as well as also multilateral relations, as opposed to East in 1989. Or 1979. Because East implied, literally, the USSR, the Soviet Union. So, Russophobic stereotypes of liberal tradition were also favored by Cold War historiographers, even as scholars of early Russia debunked such particular, notions in terms of, this Russophobic stereotyping. Widely criticized for being anti-Semitic and extremist nationalistic, the work by Igor Safarevich of 1981, the work known as Russophobia, blamed specifically Jews seeking world rule for alleged vast conspiracy against Russia and all mankind and seeking destruction of Russia through the adoption of a Western-style democracy. After 1989, another particular discussion then pops up. You then obviously see that following the dissolution of the Soviet Union in 1991 and the collapse of communism, anti-Russian sentiment in the United States was an at all-time low. So when the Soviet Union collapsed, it seemed like, you know, the propaganda, you know, machine was cooling down in Western countries, but primarily in the US. And that this particular cooling down was sort of like, okay, now it seems like communism doesn't exist anymore. Okay, now it seems like there's no other particular existential threat scenario. However, and this is a particularly important point. The anti-Russian sentiment experienced a resurgence during the late 90s due to Russia's opposition to the enlargement of NATO. So the moment that the discussion, because remember guys, let me put this again to you. Just remember the singularly important point. When the Soviet Union broke up into these smaller countries, right? One of the negotiations that obviously took place was the negotiations around the reunification of Germany, meaning East and West Germany uniting again. The collapse of the Berlin Wall, the introduction of many of the socialist satellite states. So we're talking about Poland, we're talking about Hungary, we're talking about, they were Czechoslovakia, now they're Czech Republic and Slovakia. And then the guys, obviously, that were formerly Yugoslavia, those were the satellite states. They were the guys that were the Iron Curtain, you know, the buffer zone between the Soviet Union and Western Europe. When those negotiations took place, one of the key stipulated points, and I've done this before here on my Sunday Morning Take, is that NATO should not expand. NATO's expansion should not include Ukraine. I'll say that again. This was pre-negotiated. NATO should not expand, and NATO's expansion should not include Ukraine. Now, obviously, subsequently from 1991, heading this way up until 2025, Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia, which were former Soviet states, direct Soviet states, not socialist satellite states like Poland, and Hungary, direct Soviet states, they were Soviet territories, all became NATO members. But Russia said, no, that's fine, those guys can join. At one stage, it is now publicly known, when Putin first became president, he also wanted to become part of NATO. Until his famous 2008 Munich Security Conference speech. I'll say it again, until his famous 2008 Munich Security Conference speech. That 2008 conference speech laid the foundation for what you see happening today in Ukraine. So, the particular sentiment also was, and if you also don't know, which is the discussion I also shared earlier on my Sunday Morning Take here, but it actually was last year that I shared this, is the reason as to why Ukraine is a non-negotiable subject matter. Even though Ukraine is an independent state, it's a sovereign state itself, the negotiations were clear. Guys, there's a reason why when people enter into contracts, you've got to adhere to the contract. If you're a politician, you've got to adhere to a contract. You as a politician, it does not make you, you don't have a better position above a contract. It's a legally binding document and it has cost lives. It costs lives and it costs money. Understand things before you enter into them. So, and obviously we're obviously seeing the antics of the NATO countries. So, one of the things that were on the table is that Ukraine is the only and single most last straw of joining NATO. It technically also included Georgia, because Georgia was also a former Soviet state, a Soviet territory, which obviously led to the 2008 Georgia border war, which established that other particular territory. Primarily because Georgia also wanted to become a NATO member. And the second scenario was that specifically Ukraine popping up in here in the 20 teens. Now, if you don't know, Ukraine is also part of what is known as the Commonwealth of Independent States. The Commonwealth of Independent States, dear listeners, are a collective of former Soviet territories, former Soviet Union territories. That includes Russia, Ukraine, Belarus, and all the other stans, the Tajikistan, Azerbaijan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan. It includes those guys. The CIS was established immediately after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Immediately after. They have an economic policy. They have a foreign relations policy. They are headquartered, the CIS's headquarters is in the capital of Belarus. I just forgot the city's name, guys. That's why I mentioned the country. You know, my geography sometimes is not all, you know, 100% some mornings, but yeah. So, Minsk, yes, in Minsk. That's Belarus's capital. So, all these particular details exist. They exist. They're not hidden behind some security, you know, walls somewhere on the internet. They exist freely. They exist. So, it obviously explains to you the discussion based upon these particular scenarios. Reason being, agreements were signed. Agreements were agreed to. Now, one of the obvious indications, obviously, where I ended off was that, you know, the resurgence came back in the 1990s due to the opposition by Russia to the expansion of NATO. Because one of the things on the table, one of the agreements on the table also was that NATO should also be disbanded. But NATO obviously has not been disbanded, has it? No, it hasn't. So, according to a Gallup poll, 59% of the surveyed Americans viewed Russia negatively by 1999, compared to the 25% that was measured in 1991. Another particular academic, Anatol Levin, considered the Western commentary on the Second Chechen War and the Russian reaction to the eastward NATO enlargement to be the main cause of the growing Russophobia in the 90s, condemning the brutality of the Russian army and an exaggerated fear of NATO. Levin also argued that the influence of the Cold War elites and the ethnic lobbies, coupled with the 19th century stereotypes about Russian expansionism, led to Western journalists and intellectuals to drop professional standards and to literally engage in propaganda, spreading Russophobia and national hatred. By April of 2007, a man by the name of David Johnson, who was the founder of Johnson's Russia List, said in an interview to the Moscow News, open quote, "I am sympathetic to the view that these days Putin and Russia are perhaps getting too dark a portrayal in most Western media, or at least that critical views need to be supplemented with other kinds of information and analysis. An openness to different views is still warranted." End of quote. A California-based international relations scholar, Andrei Tsigankov, has remarked that anti-Russian political rhetoric coming from Washington circles has received wide echo in American mainstream media, asserting, open quote, "Russophobia's revival is indicative of the fear shared by some US and European politicians that their grand plans to control the world's most precious resources and geostrategic sites may not succeed if Russia's economic and political recovery continues," end of quote. On top of this, another academic by the name of Kristina Kurtsap-Redlich and other reporters, these are now obviously media personalities, who were active in Chechnya, alarmed already in the early 2000s that Putin's true nature and intentions have been exposed by the Russian atrocities during the Second Chechen War, as by no means resembling those of a Western Democrat. Now, on top of this, it was, however, convenient for the Western elites to brand these reports as Russophobic and disregard them. in spite of these particular reports being delivered also by another particular Russian journalist known as Anna Politkovskaya, who is also a human rights activist, as she was also later on assassinated. Now, first among these particular views has also ultimately suffered discreditation in the humiliating manner after 2014, primarily because it was inherently flawed as it focused exclusively on the fantastic motivations behind anti-Russian sentiment in Western Europe, while entirely disregarding the precisely specified reasons of negative views of Russia in Central and Eastern Europe, which stem in turn from real experience and knowledge. So in October of 2004, the International Gallup Organization announced that according to its poll, anti-Russian sentiment remained fairly strong throughout Europe and the West in general. It found that Russia was the least popular G8 country globally. Overall, the percentage of respondents with a positive view of Russia was only at 31%. Anti-Russian sentiment in the United States and Western Europe countries, or Western European countries, had decreased during the presidency of Dmitry Medvedev, with about half of the respondents in US, UK, Germany, Spain, and France having positive views of Russia in 2011. It also began to increase again after 2012, with the Transatlantic Trends 2012 report indicated that the views of Russia turned from favorable to unfavorable on both sides of the Atlantic, noting that most Americans and Europeans, as well as many Russians, said they were not confident that the election results expressed the will of voters. Now, attitudes towards Russia in most countries worsened considerably following Russia's annexation of Crimea. The subsequent fomenting of the 2014 pro-Russia unrest in Europe and its intervention in the resulting war in Donbass. Now, from 2013 to 2014, the median negative attitudes in Russia, or in Europe, sorry, in Europe, rose from 54 to 75% and from 43 to 72% in the US. Negative attitudes also rose compared to 2013 throughout the Middle East, Latin America, Asia, and Africa. According to the political scientist Peter Schulze, the accusations of collusion with the Trump campaign coupled with the criminal case of Lisa F. If you have never heard of Lisa F., it's an alleged criminal case where a 13-year-old Russian-German girl was reported missing for over a day in Berlin in January 2016. And after returning, she first claimed that she had been kidnapped and raped by three strangers. Now, the case was probably used by Russian officials and media to literally accuse Germany of tolerating and covering up child abuse. These accusations then provoked demonstrations of Russian Germans in several cities in Germany, and the kidnapping story was shortly after proven to be false by police after analysis of mobile phone logs and Lisa herself admitting that she went into hiding voluntarily and that she wasn't sexually assaulted. So, a German citizen of a Turkish origin with whom Lisa stayed during the disappearance admitted, obviously, you know, having a relationship with this particular girl, with her previously, and was found guilty of child abuse and producing, you know, not so good content. Now, the police also investigated another man who also had particular contacts with this girl before her disappearance, who was also a Turkish citizen, and the charge against him was later on dropped as he was not aware of the girl's real age. Now, the reason why she's known as Lisa F., dear listeners, is because she was still a minor at the time that this particular event took place, so they obviously had to protect her identity. So, obviously from that particular criminal case that, you know, occurred in Germany at the time, which was reported in Germany as an instance of Russia's hybrid war. This is obviously the propaganda war and other particular deployed mechanisms, sparked fears that the Kremlin could meddle in German campaigns as well, resulting in the growth of anti-Russian sentiment in Germany after 2016. By 2020, the majority of Western nations had unfavorable views of Russia, with an exception of Italy, which was attributed to by the Pew Research Center to delivery of medical aid by Moscow early during the pandemic. 85% of Americans polled by Gallup between 1 and 17 February 2022 had an unfavorable view of Russia. We obviously know of the discussion post 2022 after the start of the particular war. And this obviously had to indicate, you know, just how far this particular discussion of anti-Russian sentiment actually went. Now, it is pretty high, obviously, in a country like Ukraine. Japan is also one of the countries that has a high particular rating against Russia, but it's pretty high specifically in many other countries. It gets extensively low if you head into some parts of South America and some parts of the rest of the world. For example, the anti-Russian sentiment gets low, the lowest I see specifically like in places like Indonesia, Malaysia, Saudi Arabia and Morocco, Egypt as well, Pakistan as well. China is at 7%, Algeria is at a 6% low, Vietnam, and even India. And this is even on the conversation of, you know, if you look at the democracy index perception, or democracy perception in index of 2024, which was a question that was asked by, you know, the agency that obviously measured this particular index. What is your overall perception of Russia? Negative. You had a whole bunch of neutrals as well, but the overall weighting, it gets pretty low and it gets pretty positive the moment you start heading to the lower percentage measuring scenarios, that I just recently mentioned. Then there's obviously with the other countries like Azerbaijan and Georgia, they have their distinct relationships with Russia and in their own scenarios. And then there's obviously the historic, you know, the lingering historic, sentiments that obviously still persist. Now, this ultimately brings us, dear listeners, to the last 10 minutes of this morning's program. We'll quickly be stepping into a musical break. After that, we might be at the end of our discussion for this morning. Then I'll only be obviously saying our goodbyes and obviously you'll have to, you know, stay tuned for the rest of the programming to come after. This morning session of my Sunday Morning Take. On that note, dear listeners, we're quickly stepping into that short musical break. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in parliament, let me not take up my Katatura manners.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to.
Be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Put your faith in something beautiful. Sell your reflection to the traveling show. We leave ourselves a lot to answer for. I've left myself and now I wanna go home. And up there in your treehouse,
Dates and politicians go bumping the night. It'll take more than a Superman to make us think that everything's alright. There's nothing on the radio. They're all talking like they're falling in love. There's nothing on the radio. And then it hits me like a fist from above. I want love, I want love. I want love, I want love. I want love. Remember all the promises we made, but they're like white noise to us now. We light our match and walk away, beside ourselves and it's easy. These days are written on our face, and in the faith that we can change the script. You'll know me better than I'll ever know myself if you see. Take it easy on me. Nothing on the radio. They're all talking like they're falling in love. Nothing on the radio. And it hits me like a fist from above. I'm singing out. You better get here soon. You better get here soon. There's nothing on the radio. They're all talking like they're falling in love. Oh, there's nothing on the radio. And it hits me like a fish from a bubble. Sing it out. I want.
And right there with the sound specifically of New Guinea with the song Marekia. And just before that was a little bit of Paolo Nutini with the song Radio. Does bring us up to the top of the hour at 7 a.m. Obviously, if you've just woken up, good morning. If you haven't been, you know, awake since now, and actually a little bit earlier, obviously, you were in the company, obviously, of yours truly, that being me, Dwight, here on my Sunday morning take. And just as always, as we always do, wishing you well for the rest of your Sunday programming in our company. And let's see each other again, same time, same place next week, or alternatively during the course of this week on The Home Run. And in that note, dear listeners, enjoy the rest of your programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being Eagle FM.